From Kansas to Tennessee, Wyoming to Georgia, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, Elizabeth Warren is proposing a major hike in Social Security benefits. But what would that do to a system already in financial distress? Veronique Darugi of the Mercatus Center is here to discuss. The deadline for adoption of a new federal budget is October 1st. Will Congress get the job done? Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. The attack on Saudi oil fields has some beating the war drums with Iran. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine discusses the wisdom of a counterattack with Chris Preble from the Cato Institute. And there is a lot of talk from the left about corporate greed, but there is also government greed. Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, explains on this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Democrat presidential candidates are promising voters a wide range of taxpayer-paid goodies, including so-called free college and Medicare for all. Now, Senator Elizabeth Warren is proposing a major hike in Social Security benefits. But the system is already headed for insolvency, so is that idea even possible? We turn to Veronique Darugi for answers. Veronique is a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Veronique, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Veronique, among the many free things, quote-unquote free things, that Democratic presidential candidates are promising, Elizabeth Warren came out with something new, promising more Social Security dollars for those who are on Social Security. I would be interested in your thoughts as to the feasibility of that proposal.
It's kind of interesting that in spite of the deep financial problems that Social Security has and that we've known Social Security has had for decades, and the fact that we know the program is insolvent, and better yet, there's a hard deadline where benefits will be cut, there are still people who insist not just that it's not time to reform the system, but it's time to throw more money, talking about not seeing the same thing when looking at a program.
What is Elizabeth Warren promising to do to actually take place? You mentioned there's a hard deadline for cutting benefits. My assumption would be that that would speed up and move up by a lot of years, a benefit cut.
So what she wants to do is, like, she basically wants to increase the benefits, especially for lower-income earners. She wants to increase eligibility for a bunch of people. She also, there's something that interesting, and I haven't been able to actually get confirmation or details about what she wants. She talked about caregiver to be eligible for Social Security, and I was actually wondering whether she was echoing the terrible idea by conservatives that parents, for instance, could start tapping into their benefit earlier on and then pay back later with late retirement. Of course, Warren would not do any of that. She actually would just simply hope to increase spending on the rich. And in the current form, Andrew Biggs at the American Enterprise Institute has actually shown that even if you got rid of the cap on the payroll tax, which would be a tremendous increase in taxes for many, many taxpayers, the program as it is, it wouldn't be enough to make it solvent over the long run. So she should just want to increase benefit, and without really a plan to make it solvent.
You mentioned remove the benefit cap. Many Americans might be unaware of what that is because they don't hit that level.
There's a lot of misunderstanding about Social Security. A lot of people say it's a universal program, which is true. It's like everyone gets it. As long as you are eligible, which means that you've worked a certain number of quarters and accumulate basically enough points, really. And so everyone gets it, but the way we pay for it, right, is through the payroll tax. It's a two-part tax. There's a tax on employers and a tax on employees. Of course, you and I know that the tax on employers is really a tax on employees. Basically, the employee pays it in the form of lower wages. But that payroll tax is capped, I think, at 118 $1,000, maybe a little. Maybe it's changed because it changed a little bit every year. But basically, it's only the first $118,000 that people make that are subject to the payroll tax. So when they talk about lifting the payroll taxes, it means basically, if you say, let's say, make $170,000 a year, your entire income would start being taxed by the payroll tax. That's what it means. And I mean, it's a significant increase in taxes for a lot of taxpayers that make above that amount. But even that, even if you increase taxes dramatically this way, it wouldn't make the program solvent as it is.
You mentioned this hard deadline where additional money has to come in and or benefit cuts. What year do we hit that hard deadline?
So I think now it's 2035, and it's the benefits. What happens, that hard deadline, basically right now, since 2010, the program has been running a permanent cash flow deficit. It means that all the payroll tax that are collected on current workers and that go to pay current retirees are not enough to cover all these benefits that are paid in a given year. So what's happened is that the program, in order to fill that gap between the benefits that are paid and the payroll tax that is collected, basically taps into those assets that they have in the trust fund. So the trust fund assets, they come from past year of collecting more of the payroll tax than one needed to pay benefits. Of course, that money is just, it's an asset, it's a true asset, but it's actually, the money isn't there anymore because it's been exchanged for an IOU, and Treasury has spent it on all sorts of things like war and education and all sorts of things. But so these assets, at some point, they're going to be gone. They're going to all have been utilized, those IOUs, right? And by law, when that is the case, when the trust fund dries out, basically, the program has to revert to a pay-as-you-go system. And that means that basically the program can only pay in benefits what it collects in the payroll tax. And that means right now, as projected, roughly a 20% cut across the board. And of course, as it's always the case, right, it's going to be harder for people who really truly depend on Social Security, like low-income earners who really truly depend on Social Security for their retirement. I mean, 20% cut is a really big deal.
Veronique, 2035, we have about 15 years before we hit that hard deadline. Mm-hmm. What steps can be taken now that can either push that deadline further in the future or perhaps forestall it altogether?
We need to reform the program, and we need to basically reduce eligibility quite dramatically. I mean, one of the things that I recommend, that, I mean, no one agrees with me, but it's just like, I think the design of Social Security, which may have made some sense in the 1930s, which basically redistribute money from people who are working and relatively young to people who are not working and older, doesn't make any sense anymore. And the reason is that today, seniors are overrepresented in the top income quintile, and young people are overrepresented in the bottom one, and even in poverty, their poverty is increased. So basically, what the program, the way it is designed, is you're transferring massive amount of wealth from relatively young and relatively poor people towards a population that is old and relatively rich. Actually, they're the richest part of the population on average. And so it doesn't mean that every senior is rich, but we should stop this program based on age. It is meaningless at this point and is incredibly unfair because it also really discriminates against unmarried people. It also discriminates against minority and black people. And we need to move to a needs base. So meaning that it if you're old but you're in need, you would get it. But the criteria is not that you're old. That's not the point anymore. This notion of when you're old, you're poor is just completely wrong.
We have been talking with Veronique DeRugi, who is a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center. That, of course, is at George Mason University. And Veronique, tell us a bit about the Mercatus Center. Also, where can folks go on the web to read your writings on this and other topics?
The Mercatus Center is a research-based center at George Mason University. And you can find my writings and all of my colleagues at the mercatuscenter.org.
Veronique DeRugi of the Mercatus Center. Veronique, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Scott Parkinson over at the offices of the Club for Growth. It is an important time in Congress. We're going to talk about that today. Scott, good to have you here.
Always great to be with you, Loman. Thank you.
Well, Scott, Congress is supposed to have a new federal budget in place because a lot of people don't remember or know this, but October 1st is the start of the new federal fiscal budget year. So in order to have the government spending money, we should have a budget in place. Of course, Scott, they're going to get it done on time, right?
Well, nothing gets done on time in Washington. Sometimes can have pieces of legislation that move the ball forward, and then they'll wrap everything up in an omnibus legislation at the end. But basically what's been happening here in Washington, been talking with your listeners for the last several months about the big budget-busting spending deal that Nancy Pelosi and Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin brokered. So that agreement got passed in July. They said if we do this big budget agreement, we're going to be able to adjudicate the normal appropriation processes and pass appropriation bills and not have these spending shutdown fights in September and October leading up to December. So here we are in the middle of September, and what do we have? We have the Democrats breaking their word in the Senate this week. They filibustered an appropriations bill that would have taken care of a majority of federal spending on the discretionary side. So we're seeing Washington instead considering another one of those continuing resolutions. In short, they're known as CRs. And the CR is going to be a seven-week stopgap spending bill that would continue on current spending levels and get us into November leading into Thanksgiving. So on one hand, it's not like the recent precedent where it's backing all the way up against Christmas, but that doesn't mean that in November they won't do another short-term three-week CR to really bring the political divide together and try to jam everything through at the end of the year.
Scott, this raises the question, if we had this big budget deal, a budget-busting budget deal last summer, and now here we are approaching the 1st of October. Since there was an overarching deal, why aren't the pieces in place on time?
These are 1,000-page bills that usually you pull out of a staffer's top drawer and just change the date on, right? But this time they did increase spending pretty dramatically, and they're also looking to add various policy riders to prevent President Trump from enacting his agenda, especially related to immigration policy. You may recall that when they did the spending agreement, there was also a handshake agreement where they said that they wouldn't have any poison pill controversial policy riders included in the spending bills, and that would allow them to move forward and basically just spend the people's money. Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, you're not going to fool me twice, right? But we've been fooled. The Democrats have pulled the rug out on the agreement to an extent, and they are looking to get additional policy riders included. So that's just created an additional negotiation. If all the leaders of the House and Senate agree upon the additional policy riders, then the handshake agreement moves forward, but if they have disagreement, then the deal is broken. So they're working with the administration to see if they can make headway in moving forward. That's why I think you're seeing a seven-week agreement for the continuing resolution. In the interim, I just think that, you know, this is reflective of a high level of dysfunction in Washington, D.C., and we are smack dab in the middle of a campaign cycle already. Even though there's 13 months to go, everybody's looking to November 2020 and what the odds are that Democrats can take the Senate, hold the House, win the presidency. Can Trump win re-election? What does the impeachment dynamic look like for 2020? So I think that's why you're also seeing the other side willing to sort of back up from the agreements that they've made and slow things down, pump the brakes.
As you mentioned, there is an extraordinary amount of dysfunction in this process normally. So how heavily are the policy battles weighing in on this? Is Congress fighting policy battles, or is all of this just political posturing at this point?
I think that there are some fights on policy, but they're not as controversial as you might imagine. I think that in the end, they can make the agreements necessary to fund government and avoid a partial government shutdown. But they're also probably trying to figure out which side a shutdown hurts more. And in the past, we've seen Chuck Schumer and the Senate Democrats hold the line and shut down government. And in other instances, we've seen Republican senators and the Republican House push back against funding Obamacare or other Obama priorities during his administration. And, you know, then the court of public opinion gets to lay out a verdict. And it's sometimes difficult to know exactly which way the wind of the sails are going to swing. So I do think that the bottom line is these spending bills are gigantic in size, scope, and cost. They're putting us into trillion-dollar deficits. There's definitely some folks on our side of the aisle that are concerned about that, but there is a large majority in Congress that would be happy just to spend those levels of money, and said they're fighting about minor policy battles that they think can swing an election a certain way.
We, of course, will continue to keep an eye on that. We're going to do that with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. And Scott, tell us a bit about the club.
Sure. The Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. Everybody in the world can join our organization for free. All you've got to do is check us out on our website at clubforgrowth.org. I encourage everybody also to follow us on Twitter at Club for Growth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth. Scott, we'll look forward to talking with you next week. Take care.
Thank you.
The Trump administration says Iran is to blame for last week's attack on Saudi oil fields. So how should the United States respond? Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine explores the options with Chris Preble of the Cato Institute. Eric?
Iran's Foreign Minister Javad Zarif has promised all-out war would be the result if either Saudi Arabia or the United States attack Iran in response to attacks that were carried out either by Iran or Iranian-backed rebels last weekend targeting a Saudi Arabian oil facility. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Chris Preble. He is the Vice President for Defense and Foreign Policy Studies at the Cato Institute in Washington, D.C., and he is here to walk us through the complex machinations that are unfolding as the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the Islamic Republic of Iran seem to be moving closer to a potentially very disastrous conflict over the Middle East. Chris, thanks for taking some time and joining us here today.
Sure, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So Iran's foreign minister on Thursday promising that all-out war would be the result if there's an attack on Iran in response to this attack that happened in Saudi Arabia last week. Is this just more saber-rattling, or is this a significant step towards an actual armed conflict, Chris?
Well, I certainly hope it's not a step towards potential conflict, and threats can be a deterrent. The Iranians are still maintaining that they were not behind the attacks over the weekend on the Saudi oil facility. I think many observers are skeptical of that, just sort of the sophistication of the attacks, the level of coordination, people believe, is beyond the capabilities of the Houthi rebels in Yemen, who claimed responsibility immediately after. I think that the overarching point for me is that the Iranians are under, as the Trump administration says, maximum pressure. That includes trying to choke off the flow of Iranian oil from Iran out to the global oil markets. The effort has not been entirely successful, but it has definitely inflicted enormous pain on the Iranian people. And I think this last series of incidents, as well as some earlier attacks in the summer on some shipping inside of the Gulf, is Iran's way of saying, if you're going to impose pain on us, if you, the United States, are going to impose pain on us, we also have the ability to inflict pain on others.
I do want to talk about America's response, because I think that's ultimately the most important issue. But when it comes to Iran saying, no, we didn't do this, it was these rebels, doesn't Iran lose a little bit of credibility here? Because they've outsourced their some of their dirty deeds in the past to, you know, I'm thinking Hezbollah operating against Israel from Lebanon. and now the Houthi rebels down in Yemen. Everybody knows that those groups are tied to Iran. At the end of the day, is it really materially different if Iran is doing this or if they're passing this off to another group?
Again, I think in this case, the level of operational control that Iran has over the Houthi rebels is nothing approaching that of a longstanding relationship, for example, with Hezbollah in Lebanon. So I think it's important to sort of draw those distinctions. The Yemen situation is a civil war. It has been going on for a number of years. Iranian support for the Houthis, to the best of our knowledge, post-dated Saudi involvement and support. So again, I do think it's important to draw distinctions between the Houthis as proxies for the Iranians and their other relationships and affiliations with proxy groups in the region over several decades.
We are talking with Chris Preble. He is the Vice President for Defense and Foreign Policy Studies at the Cato Institute. Chris, I think that last answer really speaks to the complexity and the complications that exist in trying to craft some sort of response to any incident in the Middle East, for that matter, but certainly one that involves really two of the regional powers in Iran and Saudi Arabia. What is it that American policymakers are trying to sort through at the moment? Because, again, I imagine this is a very complex situation where it's not easy to say who are the good guys and who are the bad guys necessarily, and certainly even harder to say what the United States should do. So I'll put it to you. What should the United States be doing right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think that your point is exactly right. This is a lot more complicated and less black and white than the administration would have you believe. And, you know, for a number of years, we've been sort of subjected to a story where the Saudis are the good guys and the Iranians are the bad guys, or at least the Saudis are the less bad guys and the Iranians are the worst bad guys. I think that there's been some healthy pushback on this narrative over the course of the last year, certainly worsened by the brutal murder of Jamal Khashoggi, the Washington Post journalist in the Saudi consulate in Turkey. The much greater issue is this horrific war in Yemen, which is just subjecting millions and millions of people to, candidly, the worst humanitarian crisis on the planet right now, in one of the poorest countries on the planet. So I think that the complexity of this story is now breaking through, that it is not as simple as the Iranians attacked this noble, reliable ally of the United States, and therefore the United States' only recourse is to respond on behalf of the Saudis. There are fewer and fewer people who are willing to make that argument in Washington, D.C., and I think that's a healthy development, even though, again, I wish it didn't have to come in the midst of a crisis and threats of war.
And we are just about out of time here, Chris, but I got to put this to you as well. I mean, any sort of military response, that's got to go in front of Congress, right?
Yes, I certainly think so. Again, I'm encouraged that some members of Congress are willing to say that. But the notion that the President of the United States should be able to initiate a new conflict with a country on behalf of another country that is not even a treaty ally of the United States has generated quite a bit of healthy sort of resistance on the part of Congress, and I hope that members of Congress of both parties remember their obligations to the Constitution.
Yeah, definitely something that that Congress should have to vote on. That makes a lot of sense. We are unfortunately out of time for today. That is Chris Preble from the Cato Institute. Chris, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Eric. Anytime.
And again, Chris Preble is the Vice President for Defense and Foreign Policy Studies at the Cato Institute in Washington, D.C. You can check out his work at cato.org or head over to amazon.com and pre-order his upcoming book, Fuel to the Fire, a look at how the Trump administration has made American foreign policy worse and what America could do to recover from it. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can check out our work at reason.com, and you can catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Government greed is real and threatens the U.S. economy. So says Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, on this American Radio Journal commentary.
Be it Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Elizabeth Warren, or Bernie Sanders, the recurring theme amongst the liberals is that capitalism is inherently greedy. Allegations of Amazon corporate greed was the rallying cry to defeat the Amazon move to New York City. Elizabeth Warren even proposed a wealth tax, seemingly in the misguided effort to place everyone else's woes on those that she deems to be the cause of all of the woes in the world. What's fascinating about this entire dialogue is that these pundits seem to never attribute greed to those taking advantage of the public trust more than anyone else. our own government. The public sector has grown exponentially since the 1930s. According to the St. Louis Federal Reserve, the net federal outlays since the 1930s have grown from less than 5% of GDP to almost 20% of GDP in 2018. Government is the new big business. It is a monopoly. Its policies have limited effective checks and balances protecting the public that it is supposed to serve. There is no Sherman Antitrust Act or Clayton Antitrust Act to protect us from government. All we have is a legislative process and a judicial system that is supposed to protect us from the very government we elected. That all works well, and our Constitution is designed for those checks and balances, until the bureaucracy has greater control than the very legislative and judicial processes created by our founders to protect us. The absolute disgrace of the actions of senior members of the FBI, as well as the continued exoneration of those public sector employees abusing the public trust, causes one to question who is truly running the government. Is it the elected official or the bureaucracy that is in control? One example for a lack of constraint on government is the public sector pensions. Over the past two decades, corporate America has reined in the defined benefit pension plans, such that the Americans most are covered only with a defined contribution plan and Social Security. Businesses realized decades ago that they could not survive with the pension systems then in place. Free markets required that they address the problem, and they did. Alaska, California, Illinois, Connecticut in particular are among the greatest distressed from such generous and yet unfunded pension plans, which is now over $5.2 trillion unfunded. In a normal world, it would not be sustainable, but in government, the taxpayer and their property is the unlimited checkbook to continue this charade. Eventually, because most states prohibit renegotiation of labor contracts for state workers and teachers, states that did not address this unsustainable pension obligation will find themselves unable to sustain their budgets towards the next recession. In the private sector, workers, shareholders, and management all risk failure. That's the self-policing mechanism that prevents one side from abusing the other, because the consequence is bankruptcy. When such situations have gotten out of control, bankruptcy has ensued and everyone was hurt. Unfortunately, in the public sector, bankruptcy at the state level is incredibly rare, with the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico being the exception. There is no incentive at the state level for parties to a transaction to negotiate settlements for the best interest of all concerned. Instead, what happens is that the public sector employee can force higher taxes on other citizens to pay for programs not available in the private sector. The only option for the taxpayer is to leave the state. But whenever you are dealing with other people's money, the operative word becomes greed. True power is in the hands of those writing the laws and controlling the bureaucracy. There is no incentive to change because the taxpayer has no option and is at the mercy of a person that they elect, or so they think. Therein lies the fallacy, because failure of the state is, in fact, an option. A segue to this, in the 1970s, the nation faced a tremendous dislocation in the steel industry. The reality of what triggered the steel demise is now apparent, with eerie parallels in government. One of the causes of the lack of competitiveness in the steel industry resulted from the almost monopoly-like control the industry had on post-World War II world. The monopoly of the steel industry led to JFK's incendiary attacks against the steel industry, which were legendary at the time. The steel industry refused to believe that times had changed and then businesses failed. Government, likewise, has refused that times have changed and states will fail. Greed is greed, no matter the source, and it will be punished by the free market system. For the American Radio Journal, this is Frank Ryan.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WCPC-AM in Tupelo, Mississippi, WITK-AM in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, along with KWDF-AM in Alexandria, Louisiana. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.